Chapter 23. A bright sun and warm wind have followed the storm. The snow cover has melted rapidly, shrinking to thin, isolated patches beneath the thickest tree cover and in protected hollows. The trail of mixed tracks that Cork had been following has vanished, but the wet ground left in the wake of the snow still offers lots of signs. Plus, Cork knows exactly where he's going. He's moving fast. Between the warming day and his physical effort, his body's pouring out a river of sweat. He removes his jacket, bundles it, and slips it into his pack. But it's not just the rising temperature or his own exertion that's making him sweat. It's something he remembers from several months earlier, something troubling. Stephen has had visions since he was a child, usually visions of dire warning. Stephen foresaw his mother's death in a vision. He foresaw the shooting that nearly left him crippled. He foresaw the fall of a plane from the sky that killed a prominent U.S. senator. And several months ago, in a vision, he saw Henry Malou lying on the ground, dead. When he shared that vision with Malou, the old man's response had been a simple, "I know." That vision has been heavy on the mind of everyone who cares about the old man. Every life must end, but a world without Henry Malou is a world Cork doesn't want to begin to imagine. The midday has been a part of his life and life on the Iron Lake Reservation for as long as even the oldest of the old can remember. Malou's guidance has helped Cork and so many others untie the difficult knotted threads of their lives. Imagining the world without Malou would be like trying to imagine the world without sunshine or the songs of birds. And here's another worry. If Malou is alone, where are Rainey and Dolores? If they'd been with Malou, wouldn't they have done their best to signal the plane? They wouldn't have abandoned the old man, would they? Cork doesn't believe this for a moment. Unless Malou was beyond helping them, and beyond their help as well, as in dead. The terrain is a rugged sculpting of ridges, marshes, and streams coursing with the runoff from the snowmelt. Bushwhacking his way through the wilderness, Cork progresses much more slowly than he'd anticipated. At last, he mounts what the topo map indicates is the final ridge between him and Fisheye Lake. He pauses, winded. From where he stands, he can see the small oval of water less than a mile away. A thin finger of smoke rises, marking the location of the fire. Cork pulls out his field glasses and tries to get a better look, but the source of the smoke is hidden by tree cover. As he stands catching his breath, Cork also catches a sudden noise, distant and faint. It's barely a whisper of a sound, but in his current state of deep concern, he worries that it might have been a gunshot. It comes not from the direction of Fisheye Lake, but from the south instead. He listens intently, strains to hear more. A minute later, another faint crack like the breaking of a small twig. Now he's certain. Gunshots. Anton Morisseau is somewhere to the south, but is he near enough that Cork would hear the report of his rifle if he fired or was fired at? Cork stands atop the ridge, trying to put the pieces together. When the search plane flew over Fisheye Lake, Malou didn't move, and he was alone. As much as Cork hates to think it, he has to consider the real possibility that the old man is dead and that to save themselves, Rainey and Dolores have abandoned him. According to the topo map, the res is less than 10 miles south of Fisheye Lake. If the women move quickly, they might be able to make it before dark. They might even run into some of the search party from the res with Deputy Azevedo. This is the scenario he would love to believe, but the shots are like razor blades that cut into his desperate hope. He's wasted enough time. He starts down the ridge slope, moving faster than he should, fueled by his growing dread that the worst of his fears is playing out, that those he cares about so deeply are dying. Halfway down the ridge, his right foot slips out from under him on a bedding of leaves still slick from the snowmelt. He falls, tumbling over and over until he slams into the jagged edge of a small rock outcrop. He's hit chest first, a painful blow, and he lies stunned, staring up at a sky broken into blue pieces by the branches of a sapling birch. For a couple of minutes, he lies still, gathering himself and his wits. Then he tries to stand. The pain is sharp enough that he cries out. Carefully, he brings himself to a kneeling position. He sloughs off his pack, unbuttons his flannel shirt, and checks his chest. The impact site is a flaming pink streak just left of his sternum. He presses gingerly there and is rewarded with another lightning bolt of pain. Broken, he thinks. One rib, maybe two. He works at standing fully upright. When he's erect, he lifts his pack and sets it on the rock that ended his tumble. He digs into the pocket where he's kept the sat phone, thinking he needs to let Dross know the situation. What he brings out is a useless piece of electronics, cracked and broken in his fall. He looks around for the rifle he was carrying, but it's nowhere to be seen. He steels himself and begins the slow climb up the slope. The rifle is just below the mess of leaves that was his undoing. He grips it, turns, but before beginning his descent, sits a moment to rest. The water of Fish Eye Lake is still visible to him, opalescent amid all the evergreens. It's not so far, but to Cork at that moment, it seems as distant as Mars.